Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to the first installment of New Books in Military History. I'm your host, Jay Lockenauer. Every couple of weeks, I'll sit down with the author of a recent book in military history. And today, it's my great pleasure to have Professor Gregory J.W. Irwin from Temple University, who is the author of Victory and Defeat, The Wake Island Defenders in Captivity, that was published last year by Naval Institute Press. This is Irwin's second book on the subject of Wake Island. His first appeared in 1997, was titled Facing Fearful Odds, The Siege of Wake Island. And that told the story of the battle for Wake Island that occurred in December 1945. The battle for Wake Island was important at the time, especially for the American public as a kind of morale booster. It was the only bit of good news that the American public was getting in that opening month of the war as the Japanese marched from victory to victory. The Wake Island defenders held out until December 23rd. But once they enter Japanese captivity, they largely disappear from view. As Irwin tells it, the story of their 3.5 year captivity is a fascinating one. Even more so because of those 1,621 men, 85% of them returned home at the end of the war. They suffered a mortality rate of only 15%, and you can't see me making air quotes around only, because of course, that's a tragedy. There are many individual tragedies caught up in that number. But that rate of 15% contrasts starkly and quite favorably with the overall rate, mortality rate of 28%. Suffered by Allied prisoners in general, and 38% suffered by American prisoners in Japanese hands. And so to explain this disparity is the task that Irwin has set for himself. But like most great historians, Irwin also strives to tell a story. I think you can get a sense from the interview of what a good story Irwin is capable of telling, and that's what makes this book not only a meaningful piece of scholarship, but also a great read. I hope you do decide to read the book. I hope you enjoy the interview, and leave some comments on the website, friend us on Facebook, and most of all, I hope you'll be back for more. Good afternoon. It's my pleasure today to inaugurate the New Books in Military History Network by speaking with Professor Gregory J.W. Irwin, who is a professor of history here at Temple University and the author most recently of Victory and Defeat, The Wake Island Defenders in Captivity, published by Naval Institute Press in 2010. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Irwin.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Jay. Thanks.
We like to begin these interviews by having the author tell us a little bit about himself. So why don't you tell us about your background as an historian?
Well, how far back do you want me to go, Brad?
As far back as you feel is necessary.
Well, I grew up in the 60s and was influenced by the Civil War centennial. I think that put me on line to becoming a military historian. Graduated from college in 1977, earned an MA at John Carroll University, working under Donald Smythe, John J. Pershing's biographer. Then I went for my PhD work at Notre Dame and worked under Robert Lee Kirby, who, with a name like that, had to be a Civil War historian. He wrote Kirby Lee's Confederacy. And then I was lucky, especially it being 1984, I was able to land a job, really 2 years before I got my PhD, 1982, at St. Mary the Plains College in Dodge City, Kansas. And after 2 years of being the American History Department in that rather small school, I moved to a bigger place, the University of Central Arkansas, where I worked from 1984 until 1999, when I had the good fortune to join you at Temple University.
Well, we're glad to have you. All right. So you've written this book about the Wake Island defenders, but this isn't your first book about Wake Island. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came to write this one?
Well, yeah, intellectually, if I can use that term, I've spent about 30 years of my life on a desert island. I bumped into the defenders of Wake Island when I was doing my MA work in the late 70s. I was doing a thesis on George Custer and the Civil War, but was doing magazine work and had written on what happened there and got contacted by a veteran who said, "Would you like to know what really happened?" And saw a chance to maybe do some original research and some oral history, which intrigued me. And one thing led to another. I did a dissertation based on the battle for Wake Island, the short battle for Wake Island in December 1941, and the long captivity of the Wake Island defenders. And then in between other projects, I finally got around to doing a book on the fight for Wake, Facing Fearful Odds, The Siege of Wake Island. It came out in 1997 from University of Nebraska Press, and the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation gave it its book award. And then again, after doing a couple other Civil War edited volumes, I finally brought out a book about the POW experience, which is Victory and Defeat.
Well, it's a welcome addition. The book on Wake Island is a large and detailed one, and this one is also a very detailed story of these the survivors of this battle. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the circumstances in which they came into Japanese captivity. Maybe the end of the battle.
So, well, certainly, Wake Island was an American possession, 2,000 miles west of Hawaii. It was about 600 miles north of the Japanese held Marshall Islands. The U.S. Navy was trying to develop it into a kind of advanced outpost for monitoring that part of the Pacific, a lookout post for any Japanese attacks from the south toward Pearl Harbor, toward Hawaii, and a possible jumping off point for attacking the Marshalls. And so the Japanese naturally made it an early target when they opened their war against the United States on December 7th, 8th, 1941. And their first attack fails. They were spread pretty thin across the Pacific, and they had higher priority targets. So they only sent a small fleet with some outdated light cruisers and a few destroyers and small landing force. And they were repulsed by the Marine garrison on Wake, which didn't have heavy armament. It was a big victory for the Americans, and it became kind of an early rallying point coming 4 days after Pearl Harbor. But the Japanese really wanted Wake, so they reinforced the task force that was assigned to attack it. They came back on the night of December 22nd, 23rd, they landed about 900 troops on Wake under the cover of darkness. They didn't want to trade shots with the American artillery again. And they're able to overrun enough of the atoll to convince the senior American officers, who ended up being cut off from communications with troops who were still resisting. They convinced the American command at Wake that the battle was lost, and so they would surrender on December 23rd, 1941.
Great. I want to come back to that question of the decision to surrender and the issue of Wake as a symbol, because I think that's an interesting part of this story as well. And you raised the issue of the movie, which I definitely want to talk about in a bit. But first, the defense of Wake Island is really conducted on a shoestring, according to your story. I mean, preparations begin rather late.
The United States, because of its isolationist cast after World War I, is slow to react to the growing Axis threat. President Roosevelt has to disguise a lot of his attempts at military preparedness as hemispheric defense. And it isn't until early 1941, January 1941, that the government sends out civilian construction workers to try converting Wake into a seaplane base and a submarine base, largely for reconnaissance purposes. By the time the war breaks out, there are 1,146 of these contractors, as they were called, at work on the atoll. They still have a few months to go before they finish the facilities. But once the United States began developing Wake as a base, that made it all the more of a target. You know, they realized the Japanese would have all the more reason to try and seize it. So in August of 1941, they began sending small increments of Marines out to Wake to emplace seacoast artillery, 6.5-inch guns, anti-aircraft artillery, machine guns, searchlights, sound detectors, things like that. By the time war breaks out, there are 524 American military personnel on Wake. Most of them are Marines. about 380 are in a defense battalion manning the artillery. There are about 60 or so who are attached to a Marine fighter squadron, VMF 211. There are about 60 U.S. Navy personnel, and they also had about six U.S. Army radio personnel. Their job was to provide a homing beacon and communications for the B-17 bombers that the United States was trying to fly through to the Philippines, which they thought would be the deterrent to keep Japan from striking at the United States and its allies. And, of course, that strategic panacea didn't work. There really weren't enough men on Wake to hold it against a determined attack. The U.S. Navy figured you needed 1,800 to defend it against raiding parties. But they will put up an unsurprisingly fierce resistance when the Japanese come, not only in the first landing attempt on December 11th, but also during multiple air raids. The Japanese are shocked that their losses are as heavy as they were, and they're also shocked that American losses were as light as they were. Fewer than 100 Americans are killed during the defense of Wake, and about half of them are civilians.
It must have been quite a feeling to be out there on what you rightly point out is not even technically an island in the middle of the Pacific. It's an atoll, right?
Yeah.
And knowing that the Japanese Navy had its eye on you.
Yeah, well, basically, you know, you're living on what's left of the rim of an extinct volcano, and there's not much landmass there. Wake itself from tip to tip was about, I think, a 7-mile walk. And the breath. I mean, there's a lagoon in the middle there, so you're literally surrounded by water in more ways than one. And it's very low lying. People there during bad storms, they were afraid that the atoll would sink. Now it wouldn't, but I mean, that was the impression they had when the waves were coming up and covering so much of the ground to which they were clinging.
Well, we've been dwelling a bit, perhaps too much, on the earlier work, which details the battle and the ultimate surrender of this contingent on Wake Island. Tell us a little bit about that decision to surrender. You hinted that perhaps it wasn't quite justified yet. Should they have held out a little bit longer?
Well, that's a good question. Wake is 2,000 miles away from Pearl Harbor. The U.S. Navy had sent a relief force out to try and land another Marine fighter squadron and additional Marine reinforcements and other necessary things like radar and extra machine guns. But the Japanese got there first, and they get their troops ashore. And the island commander, Winfield Scott Cunningham, he was commander in the U.S. Navy, and he radios Pearl Harbor and says, "Enemy on island, issue in doubt." Pearl Harbor tells him, "You can expect no friendly forces within your vicinity for 24 hours. They never told them that they had recalled the relief force. And communications on Wake was done by field telephone, World War I technology. And when the Japanese came ashore, they cut any wires they found. So on the south shore where the enemy landed, where the most intense fighting was going on, command post after command post falls silent. And Commander Cunningham and the senior Marine commander, Major James P.S. Devereaux, they just assume that these positions have been overrun. In reality, a small group of Marines wiped out one Japanese beachhead. They killed about 100 Japanese Marines or special naval landing troops. And the main enemy landing, its west flank, was in the process of being collapsed by a counterattack led by a Marine lieutenant with four machine guns and about 60 to 80 riflemen. So they were doing real well, but the Japanese had about another 1,000 Marines offshore, and the Japanese admiral in charge of the operation, he was prepared to run his destroyers aground and send their crews into the battle with rifles. And with no protection, no relief coming, they might have held out a little bit longer, but many more of them might have died.
Your second chapter begins is titled "The Emperor Has Presented You with Your Lives," and I think that's a telling introduction to the story of their captivity. What were their feelings as they entered Japanese captivity?
It's intense shame. Some of the Marines that I interviewed, they insisted to me, "I didn't surrender. my officers or my officer or officers surrendered me, ordered me to surrender. They were trained that Marines don't surrender. That was a mantra that was drummed into their heads going back to the their wars in the Banana Republics where they're fighting bandits and rebels who didn't take POWs. So, I mean, and also they believed that the Japanese wouldn't take prisoners. I mean, they were privy to the news reports coming out of China, the rape of Nanking, etc. So, I mean, these guys thought, okay, I'm signing my death warrant. Maybe the Japanese will spare the civilians, but they're going to kill me. And the Japanese made every indication that that was their plan. They stripped these guys down to their underwear, completely naked. They bound them with telephone wire. They lined them up in front of machine guns. And it wasn't until the admiral commanding the fleet came ashore, and sometimes he had to argue with subordinate commanders, but these guys were routed up. Some of them were given some clothing back and taken to a central location where the body language of the enemy didn't indicate that they were going to die that day.
Fortunately for them, that one of the sort of amusing moments in this episode is when they're reissued clothing that they can't seem to find the proper sizes. And you mentioned that most of these were all men, first of all, and they were almost universally in excellent physical condition because they'd been working hard on this island for at least several months. And I wondered where all the size 42 and 44 pants came from that they all seemed to find.
There are a lot of big Mormons, construction workers up there. The contractors, they could work as much overtime as they wanted. And that's why a lot of those guys went out there. It's the Depression, and they wanted to make as much money and get back home to tide them over during slack periods in construction. But but they were fed. The civilians were fed very, very well. Their camp galley was going 24/7, and a guy could go in and just eat whatever he wanted. So you could be in good shape but still be husky on Wake Island. The Marines weren't fed that well. But the Japanese with the clothing, all they did was, after they get concentrated the POWs, they just bought piles of the stuff that they had found. They threw it beside the POWs, and they said, you've got to get dressed, and speedo, you only got a few seconds. So people just grabbed what they could, and they did some swapping later, but as you know, some of them ended up with clothing that didn't quite fit them.
Most of the captives were eventually shipped to China for long-term internment. But tell us a little bit about the time that they did spend on Wake, those initial days.
Well, once the frenzy of battle cooled and the Japanese landing troops kind of got over the shock and grief that comes from winning a victory, in effect, they stormed a fortress and they suffered heavy losses. Once they got over that, and they knew they had the Americans under control, they moved them to these barracks that the civilians were building as part of the base facilities there, and they put them in American-style barracks. They cordoned the area off with barbed wire. But these guys were able to live, in effect, in barracks with electricity, with flush toilets, with saltwater showers. The Japanese allowed the civilian cooks to take over their galley again. And they lived off canned American food. The perishable stuff, when power went out during the siege, had spoiled. But they were able to eat, two fairly good meals a day. You'd get oatmeal in the morning and some sort of stew later in the afternoon. The Japanese put some of them to work on burial details, gathering weapons and cleaning things up. But they didn't overwork them. And they really didn't abuse them, except for a few people who they interrogated, looking for missing artillery parts. Most of the POWs, it was a relatively gentle transition to POW life, especially in Japanese hands.
And this is an important part of your story, is that in contrast to, for example, the people who are taken captive on the Philippines, that it is this sort of slow, relatively gentle introduction into POW life.
Yeah, that helped. I mean, Wake wasn't big enough for Death March. And also the siege of Wake had only lasted 16 days. So unlike the fellows in the Philippines who were holding out a baton on substandard rations from January to April, in a jungle setting, these guys aren't, they're not malnourished. They're not walking skeletons. There's some dysentery, but they're not afflicted by beriberi and scurvy and dengue and malaria and things like that. And you know, the shape you're in when you go into captivity, that makes a big difference as to your survival prospects and also how you behave. If you're not in good shape, you're concerned about number one and not as willing to make sacrifices for the common good, which is only natural.
And you do argue that one of the keys to the remarkable survival rate of these captives is their cohesion, their sense of a collective mission to survive.
Yeah, they've worked together in some cases for years. A lot of these civilian construction workers were Morrison Knudsen veterans, and they helped build the Grand Coulee Dam and other major structures in the West. And Wake was just another job. Even the newcomers, you know, assimilated quickly because Wake was isolated. You had to. These were the only people around, so they became, you know, pretty close friends. And the Marines, the same thing. A lot of these people were trained together, served together in the same unit, and combat helped to strengthen the bonds in a lot of cases too. And they retained their leadership. The Japanese don't, for the most part, separate their officers and don't take away the civilians. Foreman. So when the leadership asserts itself in prison camp, the rest of the organization, for the most part, I mean, there are certain lapses and failures, but for the most part, the organization responds.
And it's the Marine commander, Major Devereaux, who plays an important role in that, right? I mean, he's, if there is a protagonist to the book, I guess you could say he's it.
Yeah, Devereaux, I guess, emerges as one of the heroes in the story. Commander Cunningham, who was senior to him, arrived at Wake on the 28th of November. So he doesn't really have the bonds with the garrison that Devereaux does. And Cunningham kind of removes himself from the group early on. He participates in an unsuccessful escape attempt. So the Japanese place him in close confinement in Shanghai. Devereaux was one of the most hated Marines of his time. He was an aloof martinet. He came from an aristocratic background. He was a cold and reserved man. I met him in the mid-80s, and I can testify to that. I mean, he wasn't as pleasant to me, but there was this sense that he was better than I was and everyone else in the room. I don't know if I can say this, but could I reveal what the troops called him behind his back?
I'm sure you can. This is the internet.
Okay. His initials, his first three initials are JPS, James Patrick Sonat. And then Devereaux, the troops used to say that the JPS stood for just plain shit. Guy with these white glove inspections, he'd write people off, deny them liberties for trivial offenses. He does a good job, though, with the defense of Wake. It was his idea to wait on December 11th until the Japanese came to within point-blank range by artillery standards, 4,500 yards, before his guns opened up. He played possum, and that's how he sank one of their destroyers and routed the rest of their task force. But to get to your question, that insistence on military discipline, military courtesy, military order, remembering that you're part of a group, that you are accountable for your actions, even though you're a POW, you're still a Marine, you're still a sailor, you're still a soldier, you're a civilian, you're still an American, you're part of this group. He is going to be one of the prime props for that attitude, especially among the Wake Islanders. There are going to be other people from other groups who come in who support that position. But Devereaux, as far as the Wake Island Marines and their auxiliaries are concerned, he's the guy that makes sure that they don't do things for which they would be ashamed when they got home.
So you described your initial experience of captivity as a pleasant is not the right word, of course, but a gentle introduction to captivity. But their trip to China was certainly no picnic.
The Japanese take on January 12th about 1,200 of them and put them on a converted luxury liner that's pressed into Imperial Navy service with the start of the war, called the Nita Maru, for transportation to Shanghai. The POWs are crammed into holds. They don't get near any of the nice cabins or anything like that. And there's a 50-man guard detail on the Nita Maru. So, you know, they're worried about keeping all these guys under control. But at the same time, these Japanese troops, they haven't seen combat yet. They're kind of eager to prove that they're as full of Bushido as the next guy, and they go out of their way to intimidate the POWs by, well, from the moment they come on board, beating the living stuffings out of them. And then, they have all these rules and regulations, and if they see anybody deviating, like, talking without permission, they'll just stand them up or make them hang from a girder and just beat them until he's senseless. And so they're trying to maintain order, but they got a lot of pleasure out of what they were doing too.
How long did this trip to China last?
Well, they go to Yokohama and they drop off some people that the Japanese Naval Intelligence want to interrogate, about 20 Marines and sailors with backgrounds in aviation and communications. And by the 24th of January, it's 12 days after the ship left Wake, it docks at Shanghai and then takes the Wake Islanders and some British and American POWs who were captured in Shanghai, a couple of gunboat crews and naval personnel from attached to the British and American consuls, takes them down along the Wengpu River to a town called Wusong, and they march to a POW camp 5 miles from the Wengpu River.
And you deem that a bit of good fortune as well, being held in or near Shanghai, at least.
Shanghai is the fifth largest port in the world. It's one of the largest cities in East Asia. It's one of the most prosperous cities in East Asia. It has a large international settlement that contains about 10,000 Europeans, largely Americans and Britons. And these people, the Japanese don't intern them right away. They're running loose for the better part of another year while the Japanese learn how to manage the Shanghai economy by looking over their shoulders. But the U.S. dollar and the British pound went a far, far way in East Asia. These people are rich by most standards of judgment. And when they hear that their fellow countrymen are kept as POWs, the British had their own association. The Americans had their own association. They're willing to contribute all kinds of stuff, old clothing, and books, and magazines they're not interested in anymore. One American dentist who was going to be repatriated gave his entire dental parlor to the POW camp. And after a U.S. Navy dentist arrived from North China, he was captured with the Marines guarding the legation at Beijing. POWs had full dental services. I mean, he could do everything except make dentures, but he could do all the other work, fillings, extractions. They ended up with one of the best health facilities in any Japanese POW camp in the war. And also these people were happy to work with the Red Cross, which was also active, the International Committee of the Red Cross. Shanghai was one of the few cities where the Japanese let it operate behind their lines. And they're support the effort to get extra food and other amenities into the POWs.
I gather that the doctor played an important role as well. Was he one of the original Wake Islanders, the camp doctor?
This was a dentist. When the North China Marines, as they were called, when they come in shortly after the Wake Islanders arrive, they bring two Navy surgeons and a dentist with them. The Wake Islanders had a Navy doctor, too, a doctor named Khan. The Japanese stripped him of most of his medical equipment. In fact, his early operations, he was performing appendectomies with a razor blade and sewing people up, doing sutures with regular thread and fishing line, whatever they could find. In fact, he didn't have drains to insert in these incisions, but he remembered reading an article in a medical journal that had an experimental procedure which said, after you take out the infected appendix and you sprinkle sulfur drugs inside the incision, sew it back up. And he tried it and he said, well, nobody died. So I guess it worked. But after the North China Marines come, they have an interesting status. They thought that they were going to be repatriated under the Boxer Protocol. Because they were guarding diplomatic missions. And the Japanese end up making them POWs, but they treat them differently because they're not sure either until they get verification from Tokyo. So the North China Marines come into prison camp with basically all their personal property. Each enlisted man could carry a sea bag and a foot locker. The officers had more baggage. They even smuggled in 24 bottles of scotch. The Japanese didn't search their luggage because, again, they thought they might be diplomatic personnel. And their medical people came in with a supply, a limited supply, of medical supplies and instruments. The Red Cross will help bring in more medical supplies. And also the Japanese doctor at the camp, a doctor named Shindo, a young man who'd been educated in Europe, educated in Germany, which gave him a different look at health matters. The Japanese tended to think that, you know, if you got sick, you were letting down the team and you didn't deserve extra care and extra resources to get well. It was just your duty to do it. But Dr. Shindo, because he had been educated in the West, if you're sick, it's not your fault. We've got to get you better. So he tried to get the American medics Japanese supplies, and also saw to it that the POWs were regularly inoculated for various kinds of diseases like typhoid and cholera and things like that. He also would have them weighed every so often, and you see in their diaries that going through a rough period, a food shortage, and the Japanese would weigh them. And then after the weigh-in, Japanese wouldn't make any kind of announcement. Rations would go up a bit. So this doctor was making an effort to keep as many POWs alive as possible. And again, that was a rarity in the Japanese camps.
That's a good segue to discussing one of the other strengths of the book, which is not just that you tell the story of this relatively diverse group of Americans and with a few British in the camp as well, but you shed a lot of light, I think, on the Japanese as well. And there are Japanese voices present in the book. What does that tell us about this? What is, I think, in the American imagination, kind of axiomatic Japanese cruelty?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, a lot of the books on POWs reinforced by films like The Bridge on the River Kwai. The Japanese are slaves to Bushido, that they're indoctrinated in this fierce medieval code that makes them view anyone who surrenders, anyone who doesn't die fighting for his country or his emperor, as a weakling, as someone beneath contempt, not deserving the resources necessary to keep them alive, or someone that, if you're going to feed them and keep them alive, you'll work them very, very hard so they will support the Japanese Empire, the Greater East Asia, a co-prosperity sphere, as the Japanese called it. But the Japanese, you know, Bushido got mongrelized in the 1930s. There was a lot more chivalry woven into the original code of the samurai. And when Japan, modernizes and embarks on its imperialistic course in the late 19th, early 20th centuries and starts fighting wars like the Russo-Japanese War, the Japanese military goes out of its way to treat POWs well. During the Russo-Japanese War, Japanese paid Russian prisoners twice as much as they paid their own troops. And there was no Geneva Convention talking about, you know, paying enemy POWs, but they were getting not only regular rations, but extra money to buy goodies and things like that. The Japanese, again, treated German POWs well during World War I. Their idea was to show the West that we possess, and they use this phrase, Christian values. After Versailles, though, and when Japan came away feeling the West didn't respect it anymore, there's a change in attitude. We're going to not oppress the West. We're going to expel the West from Asia. And that affects how Bushido is taught to the nation. Japanese military, which is really running the country, wants to create this kind of great pool of conscripts who will fight like all the Dickens when Japan goes to war. And there's this, you know, there's this resentment of Westerners. You know, you look down on us. When Westerners come into Japanese hands, first of all, if you're alive, because you're a weakling, you have no honor. And secondly, you're the guy I'm going to take out this generation of resentment on. You know, I'm going to show you who is superior. So that's at play in a lot of Japanese camps. But we're dealing with individuals too, and not everyone did that. You know, even in some of the worst camps, you hear stories of humane treatment. The Lake Islanders, they tended to run into a higher percentage of Japanese who broke with cultural norms and behaved in a different manner, what we would consider compassionate. Also, you know, because they're at Shanghai and because Shanghai has always been a kind of show place, it looks like the Japanese high command wanted that camp to be a show camp, even though the Japanese weren't living by the Geneva Convention. They didn't want the rest of the world to think that. And they try to use Shanghai, turn it into a model camp. They bring in reporters and newsreels, take a bunch of pictures, make a big magazine that looked exactly like Life magazine. They called it Freedom. They printed it in English. They circulated it widely. Some of the pictures, in fact, that they used would be reprinted in Life in the U.S. of A. Eventually, they kind of lose interest in that. But the commandants there still feel, you know, we should try and take care of these POWs as well as we can. And since all these Westerners who are willing to subsidize the cost of doing that, why not? They could have raked off a lot of the aid that was coming in. I mean, they did. Maybe a third of it ended up in Japanese stomachs or Japanese pockets from the black market. But they let most of it get through. And that made a difference, a crucial difference in the survival of many of these men, many of these Americans and Britons.
Yeah, it's interesting that by discussing the cultural factors that may have shaped Japanese behavior, but also the individual stories, you make clear that it is ultimately a choice to be cruel or to be kind, even if the weight of culture may push in one direction or another. There are enough instances, like the doctor that you mentioned, of people behaving humanely, that it highlights those who don't. And if I recall the name, it's Ishihara is the real villain of the story?
Osamu Ishihara, who is a translator. He comes in, he's expecting the Japanese army to give him the equivalent status of an officer, but the Japanese army doesn't hand out commissions willy-nilly to unqualified civilians. So he already has a chip on his shoulder, but this guy just seemed to hate Occidentals, seemed to hate Westerners, seemed to revel in humiliating them and also physically harming them. Most Japanese personnel, most officers, don't speak English. So as translator, he is in a key position. He can misrepresent what the officers are saying, and he can also misrepresent what the POWs say in response. There was some restraint placed on those games by the fact that Major Devereaux, who had been educated in his youth in Europe and Switzerland and in other European schools, he spoke French. And the second Japanese commandant, Handlebar Hank, as the POWs called him, had been a Japanese attaché in France. And Handlebar Hank liked showing off his French to someone who could understand it. So he and Devereaux had social conversations from time to time, and I suppose Ishihara realized that there was a way for the commandant to know what was really going on in the compound. But I'm not a psychologist. The descriptions of Ishihara, he sounds like he was manic or bipolar, and he could just flip his lid at any time and grab a club the thickness of a baseball bat and just beat a POW into the ground.
Well, what were the Japanese having the prisoners do? I mean, they did work the prisoners. What sorts of activities did the prisoners engage in? The
Japanese aren't going to feed anyone unless they're productive. So they use them, the POWs, for a number of work details. They would send them out to patch roads in the Shanghai area. They'd use them as stevedores sometimes to unload ships. They had them dig big ditches without explaining the purpose. The POWs thought they might be canals or tank traps. The really big work detail begins in 1943. And it was called the Mount Fuji Project. Ishihara gathered the POWs and said, we're going to build a beautiful park and we're going to build a replica of our sacred Mount Fujiyama back home where children can play and have a good time. So they took the POWs to a site some distance from the camp. They'd march them out every day and march them back. And they began digging and building mounds, one really big mound and the smaller mounds laid out in lines leading to it. The Marines in the group soon realized the Japanese were having them build a rifle range, which was a violation of the Geneva Convention. You're not supposed to use POWs for military works or military purposes. But Ishihara, this became his pet project. He wanted it done quickly. He kept raising the quotas of dirt that the POWs had to move. This was all being done by hand tools as the mountain climbed. They were using kind of like mining carts on tracks, and they'd fill them with dirt and have to push them to the top of the big mound and turn them over. And this also coincided in 1943 and 44 with food shortages at Shanghai. The Red Cross wasn't getting as much nourishment in because they were just province throughout the entire area. Their quota was being constantly raised, and they weren't allowed to go back to camp until they finished the quota. So men would leave, you know, before the sun rose and get back to their barracks at 6, 7, 8 at night after the sun had gone down. Also, the Japanese, to speed up production, began reducing the number of men who were pushing the mining carts. So they'd have more crews, so they could push more carts. But this is happening as the hill is getting higher. So it's a tougher and tougher climb, it takes a heavy toll on the POWs. Tuberculosis starts kicking in a lot of cases, and people who have other conditions, these are exacerbated. Ishihara just revels in the suffering of the men. It's like Satan presiding over hell. That may not smack of academic balance, but it certainly is the description that the POWs would have used for that situation.
Yeah, you get a really good sense reading the book of how close they feel like they're coming to the collective end. I mean, that's the real threat to their collective survival, I think, is that moment as you get this, the work is going up and the rations are going down, and you get a real sense, palpable sense of the threat to the captives.
So even though Shanghai overall was a better camp than others, there were desperate moments there. Right.
And in some ways, it gets more desperate after they leave Shanghai, and the story gets tougher to tell too because they go off in several different directions. Where do the bulk of the captives go when they leave Shanghai?
Well, you know, it's the Japanese left about 350 prisoners on Wake when they shipped out the main group, and about 250 or 270 of them are going to end up being shipped to Japan sometime in 1942, in May and in September. The main group, the Japanese start shipping out drafts from there to work in their industries at home, steel mills and shipyards. The first draft goes out late in 42. A bigger draft goes out late in 43. Other POWs are coming in, British POWs from Hong Kong, crews from captured merchant ships. When Italy gets rid of Mussolini, they end up incarcerating Italian Marines, which improved the quality of soccer in the camp and also the choir. But the Shanghai War Prisoners Camp is finally closed on May 9th, 1945, and the remaining POWs, about 900 or so, are put on a train and ship north. They'll be detained for about a month outside Beijing, and then they're put on a train again and shipped down through Korea to the port of Pusan, as we call it today, and then they're taken over to Japan. They enter Japan in early July 1945, and then the group is broken up again. The civilians, the Italians, they end up in camps on the main island, on Honshu. Most of the American servicemen are taken to Hokkaido, Japan's northernmost island. The officers are separated from the men. They're put in a separate camp, and the enlisted men are put into two camps called Hakodate No. 2 and Hakodate No. 3, which are used to supply labor for coal mines.
Well, I hope the listeners can get a sense. I mean, of your command of the detail just in this interview is impressive, and obviously the book. You know, you had the time to pore over the documents and so forth. It's even more detailed, but it's an impressive feat to weave all these different stories together.
That was it's a big headache, you know, trying to do that in a coherent fashion. That was a real challenge. That's why I pretty much deal with the diaspora in the last chapter. Try and keep my focus on the main group at Shanghai.
I want to return to talk about the diaspora. That's one of the real tragic stories here. But were the prisoners getting any news about the war? Did they have a sense that the war was, that the Allies were winning? When they were shipped out on May 9th, you said, did they have news that Germany had surrendered?
That's an interesting story in and of itself. As part of the model camp agenda, the Japanese will present them with radios. But the radios are set up to only receive stations in Shanghai, which are under Japanese control. So you're getting direct Japanese propaganda news. But there was a White Russian station, and they will at least give you accurate news of war on the Eastern Front, or at least they'll celebrate Soviet victories. But a couple of POWs have backgrounds working with crystal sets and things like that, and they get some extra wire, and they monkey around with the radios, and one of them is converted so that you can raise the BBC from India. And I think that set was also under the right weather conditions. You get a station in San Francisco, I think it was KGEI. But I might be wrong on the call letters there. Some people will make their own crystal sets. The North China Marines, who came in with their luggage unexamined, they come in with a radio, which they eventually retrieve. So there are sources. But the Japanese, you know, they can tell if there's unusual electricity usage in the barracks. They have radios of their own, and some of these sets that the Americans are operating will cause static interference. So you've got to be careful because you could tip off the Japanese. You also have to be careful as to how many people in camp you let know about the existence of these radios, because, you know, loose lips. A guard who you might not think understands English but does could overhear a conversation. And some of these sets got discovered. They're going to be shakedowns. That's what they called these unscheduled inspections. The Japanese would find some of these sets. Others remained hidden. New ones were being made all the time. So they're getting bits of news, which would be disseminated in the form of rumors. So there are true rumors and there are false rumors circulating at the same time. The Japanese also allow in some English language Japanese newspapers, which the POWs soon realize are just full of propaganda stories about Japanese pilots after their planes have been damaged, opening the cockpit, drawing their samurai swords and knocking Allied planes out of the skies, things like that. But also each, you know, throughout the war, new groups of POWs come in, including a rising number of Allied airmen. So if a guy gets shut down at 44, it may take him 3 months of being abused and interrogation before he reaches the camp and gets released to the general population, that's a source of at least verifiable news. So looking at the diaries, and I was able to get access to a number of diaries that were secretly kept, people are hearing about, you know, the Normandy landing, about American victories and British victories in North Africa, the victory at Stalingrad. Sometimes within a few days of it happening, it's been disseminated in one form or another to the general population.
Well, I can't decide whether to, I guess we should end on a good note. So let's talk about what happens to the Wake Island diaspora before we get to the story of the liberation, which I guess is the happy ending of the story.
Well, the diaspora, you want me to start at Wake?
Yeah, well, these are the group, especially that's left behind at Wake, I think is a...
The Japanese will leave 370 or so American POWs on Wake when they take the main group up. Take the main group out on January 12th, 1942. Most of these POWs, about 350 of them, are construction workers, and they keep them by specialty because they want people who can build pillboxes and set up communication centers and lay communications wire and do all kinds of things that the Japanese feel are necessary to fortify Wake in case the Americans attack. And since they're only 2,000 miles from Hawaii, they realize that they can expect American attacks. Another 20 are American servicemen who were too badly wounded to leave on the Nita Maru. They need time to recover. They'll be shipped out in May of 1942. And 250 of the civilian construction workers would be shipped out in September. So that's when really the best records that I have for this group ends, because the only surviving records that we have, except for a rock where someone carved 98 PWs in, I think, May of 1943, Boulder, it's still there. There are no American records. The Japanese will end up executing those 100 or so POWs. A couple get killed for trying to steal food, or at least one did. But the rest are executed in October, early October 1943. The American military never made an effort to recapture Lake. But because it was in enemy hands, it would get bombed every so often. Carrier task groups would go out and harass it, destroying the aircraft there. American submarines were offshore, making sure Japanese supply ships couldn't come in. And there's an intensive bombardment by both carrier planes and also naval guns on October 5th and 6th, 1943. The Japanese commander decides, well, this is just a softening up. The Americans are going to try and land here. And so he orders them executed. He has them taken out and bound and machine gunned, shot in the back, shot down with rifles, too. Incredibly, one of the POWs got away. One of his subordinates, after they buried the dead, informed him that there was a man missing, and he ordered all the dead dug up again to verify. The guy was captured after about another week, and the admiral in charge of Wake, he executed him with a sword personally. That war crime will be discovered afterwards. And that commanding officer will be hanged after a trial, will be hanged on Guam, I think in 1947, as punishment.
So you were able to use court records to uncover this story because of the trial.
When Wake finally was taken under American control, a destroyer went out there and a Marine honor guard landed. The Japanese surrendered after their emperor had ordered the surrender. This happened in September of 1945. The first thing they asked, where are the POWs that were left here? And they got a story. Well, during the bombing raid, a bomb hit one of the dugouts, and the POWs mutinied, and they grabbed a couple of rifles. And half of them were killed by your bombs, but the other half wouldn't surrender, so we had to kill them. But this was a rehearsed story. It was just too. Everybody was giving the same story, and so the Americans began investigating and questioning people separately. One of the top aides to the island commander, he will write a confession and kill himself. And then once the story was out, in fact, this Japanese admiral, he told his officers, okay, tell him the truth. I will take full responsibility. And another interesting cultural note, even though this guy was a war criminal, because he took the responsibility, because he became kind of the martyr, he's honored in that form in his home village in Japan to this day.
But as you point out in the book, the vast majority of the other captives do manage to survive the war, and most of them, again, are liberated in Japan. Describe that moment. It's an interesting story.
Well, the emperor, after the atomic bombs hit, and there's, of course, intense debate within the Japanese government, he will take it on himself to order his people to surrender. He will, for the first time in his life, though, he will speak on the radio. His people will actually hear his voice. And he will tell them that Japan has no choice. And General MacArthur is put in charge. Douglas MacArthur is put in charge of the occupation. Before American troops can get there, though, he tells Japanese authorities, you better take care of the POWs you have. I want to know where all the camps are. The American military, the Army Air Forces, and also carriers that are operating within range will start flying relief missions. They'll start airdropping supplies to these camps. They take 55-gallon fuel drums that are empty, and they fill them up with whatever they got. K-rations, C-rations, khaki clothing, shoes, caps, comic books, magazines. And then they put these things on pallets and they push them out their bomb bays. Their parachutes attached, but the weight's too great. Parachutes get torn off. So these efforts to save POWs come, well, in one case, a Wake Islander is killed. Several Japanese civilians living in camps nearby where the barrels came down they're killed as well. So there's a note of tragedy, but for the rest of the guys, I mean, this is Christmas in August. In fact, at the camps in Hokkaido, Dr. Khan, who's there with the Marines, he's warning them, you know, you cannot eat this stuff. At least not that much of it, because it's too rich. It will kill you. Someone talked about eating a candy bar and just shaking. He said he had never felt so warm inside in his entire life, the energy that was coming into his system. So they have to acclimate to fat living. But I mean, still, to have this stuff coming down and to know that you could start ingesting it on a gradual basis, it is the greatest day of their lives. And then relief teams are going to be sent off to the various camps. Some will reach some camps sooner than later, and they'll start bringing the POWs to either airfields and eventually to ports like Yokohama, where they're put on hospital ships or other transports and taken to Guam, where the really sick guys are taken off and put in hospitals, and then taken to the States, where most of the rest will spend some time in Navy or Army hospitals to recuperate from their privations, to put weight back on, to be checked out by the doctors to make sure there aren't any kind of side effects or hidden symptoms that need to be treated. A lot of them had some bouts with tuberculosis, and so that required careful handling back then. Still does.
And of course, not surprisingly, they maintain many of their connections. There's an association of Wake Island Defenders, right? How many of them are still around?
There was. Both groups dissolved earlier in the century because the mortality rate was escalating, and they're just too old to kind of run conventions anymore, you know, to manage reunions. So they're looser bonds. And in many cases, children and wives and grandchildren have kind of stepped in, and you know, they'll have like informal reunions, or they'll bring a few veterans together. But in their prime, when I first met these people in the late 70s and through the 80s and 90s, up until the 60th anniversary in 2001, a couple of years beyond, they had their own reunions, and it was it was a sight to see. These people, time would disappear when they saw each other. They'd be boys or young men again, and reliving their experiences. They tended to dwell on humorous things. In fact, a lot of their relatives told me that the stuff that has appeared in my book, their fathers or uncles or grandfathers had never mentioned to them, because those were some of the darker things. And it's only natural you want to shield your loved ones from experiences like that.
I think your work on this book exemplifies one of the pleasures of being an historian. I mean, you getting to meet the participants, we don't all get to do that, but the travel, I mean, you traveled to Wake, to Japan, of course, coupled with the grinding work in the archive and juggling the details and telling the story, but there are some pleasures there as well.
It's a privileged existence. I don't know if you want that secret to get out, but...
Well, we're coming to the end of the interview, so maybe it'll sneak in there without anyone noticing. But I recommend the book to those who are listening. I think you get a good sense of what a gripping individual story it is, what an important collective story it is of this group of people whose experience is in some ways unique. I mean, they do have some good fortune, and it's perhaps not a typical experience, but it's a story certainly well worth telling. We like to end these interviews with by giving the author a chance to talk a little bit about what he's working on now, to see this project in a continuum of historical research that you're carrying out. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing now.
Well, I don't know if I'm working in the continuum or if I've made a break. I'm now researching an aspect of the American Revolution that I think has been overlooked. I'm looking at Lord Cornwallis's 1781 Virginia campaign. Most historians who deal with that are in such a hurry to get to Yorktown and celebrate George Washington's victory that they miss the fact that the British brought Virginia, the biggest and most populous and richest of the 13 rebellious colonies, to its knees, paralyzed in the months preceding Yorktown by attacking property and freeing slaves. And I think a social history of that campaign will illustrate how vulnerable the American Revolution was, especially a slaveholder's rebellion. I mean, they had a ready-made fifth column in Virginia, and when the British came and slaves realized that freedom was to be found among the Redcoats, lots of them fled to the Redcoats. Lots of them brought assets that the Redcoats could use, like some of the fine thoroughbred horses that the Virginians had. Cornwallis probably had the fastest moving army that was ever seen in the American Revolution. He could even mount hundreds of his infantry, which added to the terror that Virginians felt, because his troopers, in some cases, could ride 70 miles in 24 hours, and you can strike at a lot of hearts and minds when you have that capacity.
Maybe a different subject, but I'm sure there'll be a continuity, at least in terms of the skill with which the story is told. So we'll look forward to that work as well. It's been my pleasure to speak with Professor Gregory J.W. Irwin about his recent book, Victory and Defeat, The Wake Island Defenders in Captivity. It's Naval Institute Press, published in 2010. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Greg, for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Goodbye. You've been listening to the interview with Gregory J.W. Irwin, author of Victory and Defeat, The Wake Island Defenders in Captivity, on New Books in Military History. Thanks for listening.